"What are we going to do now, sir?" said Carrot, as the carriage rattled off.
"Not nervous, are you?" said Vimes.
"No, sir."
The way he said it jogged something in Vimes's mind.
"No," he said, "you're not, are you? I suppose it's being brought up by the dwarfs that did it. You've got no imagination."
"I'm sure I try to do my best, sir," said Carrot firmly.
"Still sending all your pay home to your mother?"
"Yes, sir."
"You're a good boy."
"Yes, sir."
"So what are we going to do, Captain Vimes?" Carrot repeated. Vimes looked around him. He walked a few aimless, exasperated steps. He spread his arms wide and then flopped them down by his sides.
"How should I know?" he said. "Warn people, I guess. We'd better get over to the Patrician's palace, and then..."
There were footsteps in the fog. Vimes stiffened, put his finger to his lips, and pulled Carrot into the shelter of a doorway. A figure loomed out of the billows. "Another one of them," thought Vimes. "Well, there's no law about wearing long black robes and deep cowls. There could be dozens of perfectly innocent reasons why this person is wearing a long black robes and a deep cowl and standing in front of a melted-down house at dawn. Perhaps I should ask him to name just one." He stepped out.
"Excuse me, sir," he began.
The cowl swung round. There was a hiss of indrawn breath.
"I just wonder if you would mind..."
"After him, Lance Constable!"
The figure had a good start. It scuttled along the street and had reached the corner before Vimes was halfway there. He skidded around it in time to see a shape vanish down an alley. Vimes realized he was running alone. He panted to a halt and looked back, just in time to see Carrot jog gently around the corner.
"What's wrong?" he wheezed.
"Sergeant Colon said I wasn't to run," said Carrot.
Vimes looked at him vaguely. Then slow comprehension dawned.
"Oh," he said, I see. I don't think he meant in every circumstance, lad."
He stared back into the fog. "Not that we had much of a chance in this fog and these streets."
"Might have been just an innocent bystander, sir," said Carrot.
"What, in Ankh Morpork?"
"Yes, sir."
"We should have grabbed him then, just for the rarity value," said Vimes.
He patted Carrot on the shoulder. "Come on, we'd better get along to the Patrician's palace."
"The King's palace," corrected Carrot.
"What?"
said Vimes, his train of thought temporarily shunted.
"It's the King's palace now," said Carrot.
Vimes squinted sideways at him. He gave a short, mirthless laugh.
"Yeah, that's right," he concluded. "Our dragon-killing king. Well done, that man."
He sighed. "They're not going to like this." They didn't. None of them did. The first problem was the palace guard. Vimes had never liked them. They'd never liked him. Okay, so maybe the rank were only one step away from petty scofflaws, but in Vimes's professional opinion, the palace guard these days were only one step away from being the worst criminal scum the city had ever produced. A step further down. They'd have to reform a bit before they could even be considered for inclusion in the 10 most unwanted list. They were rough. They were tough. They weren't the sweepings off the gutter. They were what you still found sticking to the gutter when the gutter sweepers had given up in exhaustion. They'd been extremely well paid by the patrician, and presumably were extremely well paid by someone else now, because when Vimes walked up to the gates, a couple of them stopped lounging against the walls and straightened up while still maintaining just the right amount of psychological slouch to cause maximum offence.
"Captain Vimes," said Vimes, staring straight ahead,
"to see the king. It's of the utmost importance."
"Yeah, well, it'd have to be," said a guard. "Captain Slimes, was it?"
"Vimes," said Vimes evenly, "with a B." One of the guards nodded to his companion.
"Vimes," he said, "with a V."
"Fancy," said the other guard.
"It's most urgent," said Vimes, maintaining a wooden expression. He tried to move forward. The first guard sidestepped neatly and pushed him sharply in the chest.
"No one is going nowhere," he said. "Orders of the king, see? So you can push off back to your pit. Captain Vimes, with a V."
It wasn't the words which made up Vimes's mind, it was the way the other man sniggered.
"Stand aside," he said.
The guard leaned down.
"Who's gonna make me?"
he rapped on Vimes's helmet.
"Copper."
There are times when it is a veritable pleasure to drop the bomb right away.
"Lance Constable Carrot, I want you to charge these men," said Vimes.
Carrot saluted.
"Very good, sir," he said,
and turned and trotted smartly back the way they had come.
"Hey!"
shouted Vimes as the boy disappeared around a corner.
"That's what I like to see," said the first guard, leaning on his spear. "That's a young man with initiative, that young man. A bright lad. He doesn't want to stop along here and have his ears twisted off. That's a young man who's going to go a long way, if he's got any sense."
"Very sensible," said the other guard. He leaned the spear against the wall. "You watchmen make me want to throw up," he said conversationally. "Poncing around all the time, never doing a proper job of work, throwing your weight about as if you counted for something. So me and Clarence are going to show you what real guarding is about. Isn't that right?"
I could just about manage one of them, Vimes thought, as he took a few steps backward. If he was facing the other way, at least. Clarence propped his spear against the gateway and spat on his hands. There was a long, terrifying ululation. Vimes was amazed to realize it wasn't coming from him. Carrot appeared around the corner at a dead run. He had a felling axe in either hand. His huge leather sandals flapped on the cobblestones as he bounded closer, accelerating all the time. And all the time there was this cry, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like something caught in a trap at the bottom of a two-tone echo canyon. The two palace guards stood rigid with astonishment.
"I should duck if I was you," said Vimes from near ground level.
The two axes left Carrot's hands and whirred through the air, making a noise like a brace of partridges. One of them hit the palace gate, burying half the head in the woodwork. The other one hit the shaft of the first one and split it. Then Carrot arrived. Vimes went and sat down on a nearby bench for a while and rolled himself a cigarette. Eventually he said,
"I think that's about enough, Constable. I think they'd like to come quietly now."
"Yes, sir. What are they accused of, sir?"
said Carrot, holding one limp body in either hand.
"Assaulting an officer of the watch in the execution of his duty, and, resisting arrest."
"Under Section Brackets VII of the Public Order Act of 1457?" said Carrot.
"Yes," said Vimes solemnly. "Yes, yes, I suppose so."
"But they didn't resist very much, sir," Carrot pointed out.
"Well, attempting to resist arrest. I should just leave them over by the wall until we come back. I don't expect they'll want to go anywhere."
"Right you are, sir.
Don't hurt them, mind," said Vimes. "You mustn't hurt prisoners."
"That's right, sir," said Carrot conscientiously. "Prisoners once charged have rights, sir. It says so in the Dignity of Man, Brackets Civic Rights Act of 1341. I keep telling Corporal Nobbs they have rights, I tell him. This means you do not put the boot in."
"Very well put, Constable."
Carrot looked down. "You have the right to remain silent," he said. "You have the right not to injure yourself falling down the steps on the way to the cells. You have the right not to jump out of high windows. You do not have to say anything, you see, but anything you do say, well, I have to take it down and it might be used in evidence." He pulled out his notebook and licked his pencil. He leaned down further.
"Pardon?" he said.
He looked up at Vimes.
"How do you spell groan, sir?" he said.
"G-R-O-N-E, I think."
"Very good, sir."
"Oh, and Constable?"
"Yes, sir."
"Why the axes?"
"They were armed, sir. I got them from the blacksmith in Market Street, sir. I said you'd be along later to pay for them."
"And the cry?" said Vimes weakly.
"Dwarfish war yodel, sir," said Carrot proudly.
"It's a good cry," said Vimes, picking his words with care. "But I'd be grateful if you'd warned me first another time, all right?"
"Certainly, sir."
"In writing, I think."
The librarian swung on. It was slow progress, because there were things he wasn't keen on meeting. Creatures evolved to fill every niche in the environment, and some of those in the dusty immensity of L space were best avoided. They were much more unusual than ordinary unusual creatures. Usually he could forewarn himself by keeping a careful eye on the kickstool crabs that grazed harmlessly on the dust. When they were spooked, it was time to hide. Several times he had to flatten himself against the shelves as a thesaurus thundered by. He waited patiently as a herd of critters crawled past, grazing on the contents of the choicer books and leaving behind them piles of small, slim volumes of literary criticism. And there were other things which he hurried away from and tried not to look at. And you had to avoid clichés at all costs. He finished the last of his peanuts atop a stepladder, which was browsing mindlessly off the high shelves. The territory definitely had a familiar feel, or at least he got the feeling that it would eventually be familiar. Time had a different meaning in L space. There were shelves whose outline he felt he knew. The book titles, while still unreadable, held a tantalising hint of legibility. Even the musty air had a smell he thought he recognised. He shambled quickly along a side passage, turned the corner, and with only the slightest twinge of disorientation shuffled into that set of dimensions that people, because they don't know any better, think of as normal. He just felt extremely hot, and his fur stood straight out from his body, as temporal energy gradually discharged. He was in the dark. He extended one arm and explored the spines of the books by his side. Ah! Now he knew where he was. He was home. He was home a week ago. It was essential that he didn't leave footprints. But that wasn't a problem. He shinned up the side of the nearest bookcase and, under the starlight of the dome, hurried onwards. Lupine Once glared up, red-eyed, from the heap of paperwork on his desk. No one in the city knew anything about coronations. He'd had to make it up as he went along. There should be plenty of things to waive, he knew that. Yes, he said abruptly.
There's a Captain Vimes to see you, said the flunky.
Vimes of the watch?
Yes, sir. Says it's of the utmost importance.
Once looked down his list of other things that were also of the utmost importance. Crowning the king, for one thing. The high priests of 53 religions were all claiming the honour. It was going to be a scrum. And then there were the crown jewels. Or rather, there weren't the crown jewels. Somewhere in the preceding generations, the crown jewels had disappeared. A jeweller in the Street of Cunning Artificers was doing the best he could in time with gilt and glass. Vimes could wait. "Tell him to come back another day," said Once. "Good of you to see us," said Vimes, appearing in the doorway. Once glared at him. "Since you're here," he said. Vimes dropped his helmet on Once's desk, in what the secretary thought was an offensive manner, and sat down.
"Take a seat," said Once.
"Have you had breakfast yet?" said Vimes.
"Now really," Once began.
"Don't worry," said Vimes cheerfully. "Constable Carrot will go and see what's in the kitchens. This chap will show him the way." When they had gone, Once leaned across the drifts of paperwork.
"There had better," he said, "be a very good reason for..."
"The dragon is back," said Vimes. Once stared at him for a while. Vimes stared back. Once's senses came back from whatever corners they'd bounced into.
"You've been drinking, haven't you?" he said.
"No. The dragon is back."
"Now look," Once began.
"I saw it," said Vimes flatly.
"A dragon? You're sure?"
Vimes leaned across the desk. "No, I could be bloody mistaken," he shouted. "It may have been something else with sodding great big claws, huge leathery wings and hot fiery breath. There must be masses of things like that."
"But we all saw it killed," said Once.
"I don't know what we saw," said Vimes, "but I know what I saw." He leaned back, shaking. He was suddenly feeling extremely tired. "Anyway," he said in a more normal voice, "it's flamed a house in Bitwash Street, just like the other ones."
"Any of them get out?"
Vimes put his head in his hands. He wondered how long it was since he'd last had any sleep, proper sleep, the sort with sheets. Or food, come to that. Was it last night or the night before? Had he ever, come to think of it, ever slept at all in his life? It didn't seem like it. The arms of Morpheus had rolled up their sleeves and were giving the back of his brain a right pummeling, but bits were fighting back. "Any of them get..."
"Any of who?" he said. "The people in the house, of course," said Once. "I assume there were people in it. At night, I mean."
Oh, yes, it wasn't like a normal house. I think it was some sort of secret society thing," Vimes managed. Something was clicking in his mind, but he was too tired to examine it.
"Magic, you mean?"
"Dunno," said Vimes. "Could be. Guys in robes." "He's going to tell me I've been overdoing it," he said. "He'll be right, too."
"Look," said Once kindly, "people who mess around with magic and don't know how to control it, well, they can blow themselves up and..."
"Blow themselves up?"
"And you've had a busy few days," said Once soothingly. "If I'd been knocked down and almost burned alive by a dragon, I expect I'd be seeing them all the time."
Vimes stared at him with his mouth open. He couldn't think of anything to say. Whatever stretched and knotted elastic had been driving him along these last few days had gone entirely limp.
"You don't think you've been overdoing it, do you?" said Once.
"Ah," thought Vimes, "jolly good." He slumped forward.
The librarian leaned cautiously over the top of the bookcase and unfolded an arm into the darkness. There it was. His thick fingernails grasped the spine of the book, pulled it gently from its shelf, and hoisted it up. He raised the lantern carefully. No doubt about it. The Summoning of Dragons. Single copy, first edition, slightly foxed, and extremely dragoned. He set the lamp down beside him and began to read the first page. Said Vimes, waking up.
"Brung ye a nice cup of tea, Captain," said Sergeant Colon, "and a fig in."
Vimes looked at him blankly.
"You've been asleep," said Sergeant Colon helpfully. "You were spark out when Carrot brought you back."
Vimes looked around at the now familiar surroundings of the yard.
"Oh," he said.
"Me and Nobby have been doing some detectoring," said Colon. "You know that house that got melted? Well, no one lives there. It's just rooms that get hired out. So we found out who hires them. There's a caretaker who goes along every night to put the chairs away and lock up. He wasn't half creating about it being burned down. You know what caretakers are like?"
He stood back, waiting for the applause.
"Well done," said Vimes dutifully, dunking the figgin into the tea. "There's three societies use it," said Colon. He extracted his notebook. "To wit, viz, the Ankh-Morpork Fine Art Appreciation Society, the Morpork Folk Dance and Song Club, and the Elucidated Brethren of the Ebon Knight."
"Why," said Vimes.
"Well, you know, fine art. It's just men painting pictures of young women in the nude. They all together," explained Colon, the connoisseur. "The caretaker told me. Some of them don't even have any paint on their brushes, you know. Shameful."
There must be a million stories in the Naked City, thought Vimes, so why do I always have to listen to ones like these?
"When do they meet?" he said. "Monday, 7:30, admission 10 pence, said Colon promptly. "As for the folk dance people, well, no problem there. You know, you always wondered what Corporal Nobbs does on his evenings off?"
Colon's face split into a watermelon grin.
"No," said Vimes incredulously. "Not Nobby."
"Yep,"
said Colon, delighted at the result.
"What, jumping about with bells on and waving his hanky in the air?"
"He says it's important to preserve old folk ways," said Colon.
"Nobby, Mr. Steel toe caps in the groin, I was just checking the door handle and it opened all by itself."
"Yeah. Funny old world, ain't it?"
"He was very bashful about it."
"Good grief," said Vimes.
"It just goes to show you never can tell," said Colon. "Anyway, the caretaker said the Elucidated Brethren always leave the place in a mess. Scuffed chalk marks on the floor, he said. And they never put the chairs back properly or wash out the tea urn. They've been meeting a lot lately, he said. The nudie women painters had to meet somewhere else last week."
"What did you do with our suspect?" said Vimes.
"Him? Oh, he done a runner, Captain," said the sergeant, looking embarrassed.
"Why?"
"He didn't look in shape to run anywhere." "Well, when we got back here, we sat him down by the fire and wrapped him up because he kept on shivering," said Sergeant Colon, as Vimes buckled his armour on.
"I hope you didn't eat his pizzas."
"Errol at him. It's the cheese, see? It goes all..."
"Go on."
"Well," said Colon awkwardly, "he kept on shivering sort of thing, and groaning on about dragons and that. We felt sorry for him, to tell the truth. And then he jumps up and runs out the door for no reason at all."
Vimes glanced at the sergeant's big, open, dishonest face.
"No reason?" he prompted. "Well, we decided to have a bite, so I sent Nobby out to the baker's, see? And, well, we thought the prisoner ought to have something to eat."
"Yes," said Vimes encouragingly.
"Well, when Nobby asked him if he wanted his figgin toasted, he just gave a scream and ran off."
"Just that?" said Vimes. "You didn't threaten him in any way?"
"Straight up, Captain. Bit of a mystery, if you ask me. He kept going on about someone called Supreme Grand Master."
Vimes glanced out of the window. Grey fog lagged the world with dim light.
"What time is it?" he said.
5 o'clock, sir."
"Right. Well, before it gets dark..."
Colon gave a cough.
"In the morning, sir. This is tomorrow, sir."
"You let me sleep all day?"
"Didn't have the heart to wake you up, sir. No dragon activity, if that's what you're thinking.
Dead quiet all round, in fact.
Vimes glared at him and threw the window open. The fog rolled in a slow, yellow-edged waterfall.
"We reckon it must have flown away," said Colon's voice behind him.
Vimes stared up into the heavy rolling clouds.
"Hope it clears up for the coronation,"
Colon went on in a worried voice.
"You all right, sir?"
"It hasn't flown away," Vimes thought. "Why should it fly away? We can't hurt it, and it's got everything it wants right here. It's up there somewhere."
"You all right, sir?"
Colon repeated. "It's got to be up high somewhere in the fog. There's all kinds of towers and things."
"What time's the coronation, Sergeant?" he said.
"Noon, sir, and Mr. Wants has sent a message about how you're to be in your best armour among all the civic leaders, sir."
"Oh, has he?
And Sergeant Hummock and the day squad'll be lining the route, sir."
"What with?" said Vimes, vaguely watching the skies.
"Sorry, sir?" Vimes squinted upwards to get a better view of the roof.
"Hmm?" he said.
"I said they'll be lining the route, sir,"
said Sergeant Colon.
"It's up there, Sergeant," said Vimes. "I could practically smell it."
"Yes, sir," said Colon, obediently.
"It's deciding what to do next."
"Yes, sir?"
"They're not unintelligent, you know. They just don't think like us."
"Yes, sir."
"So be damned to any lining of the route. I want you three up on the roofs, understand?"
"Yes, sir."
"What?" "Up on the roofs, up high. When it makes its move, I want us to be the first to know."
Colon tried to indicate by his expression that he didn't.
"Do you think that's a good idea, sir?"
he ventured.
Vimes gave him a blank look.
"Yes, Sergeant, I do. It was one of mine," he said coldly. "Now go and see to it."
When he was left to himself, Vimes washed and shaved in cold water, and then rummaged in his campaign chest until he unearthed his ceremonial breastplate and red cloak. Well, the cloak had been red once, and still was here and there, although most of it resembled a small net used very successfully for catching moths. There was also a helmet, defiantly without plumes, from which the molecule-thick gold leaf had long ago peeled. He'd started saving up for a new cloak once. Whatever had happened to the money? There was no one in the guardroom. Errol lay in the wreckage of the fourth fruit box Snobby had scrounged for him. The rest had all been eaten, or had dissolved. In the warm silence, the everlasting rumbling of his stomach sounded especially loud. Occasionally he whimpered. Vimes scratched him vaguely behind the ears. "What's up with you, boy?" he said. The door creaked open. Carrot came in, saw Vimes hunkered down by the ravaged box, and saluted.
"We're a bit worried about him, Captain," he volunteered. "He hasn't eaten his coal. Just lies there twitching and whining all the time. You don't think something's wrong with him, do you?"
"Possibly," said Vimes, "but having something wrong with them is quite normal for a dragon. They always get over it, one way or another."
Errol gave him a mournful look and closed his eyes again. Vimes pulled his scrap of blanket over him. There was a squeak. He fished around beside the dragon's shivering body, pulled out a small rubber hippo, stared at it in surprise, and then gave it one or two experimental squeezes.
"I thought it would be something for him to play with,"
said Carrot, slightly shamefaced.
"You bought him a little toy?"
"Yes, sir."
"What a kind thought."
Vimes hoped Carrot hadn't noticed the fluffy ball tucked into the back of the box. It had been quite expensive. He left the two of them and stepped into the outside world. There was even more bunting now. People were beginning to line the main streets, even though there were hours to wait. It was still very depressing. He felt an appetite for once, one that it'd take more than a drink or two to satisfy. He strolled along for breakfast at Harger's House of Ribs, the habit of years, and got another unpleasant surprise. Normally, the only decoration in there was on Sham Harger's vest, and the food was good solid stuff for a cold morning, all calories and fat and protein, and maybe a vitamin crying softly because it was all alone. Now, laboriously made paper streamers crisscrossed the room, and he was confronted with a crayoned menu in which the words coronation and royal figured somewhere on every crooked line. Vimes pointed wearily at the top of the menu.
"What's this?" he said.
Harger peered at it. They were alone in the grease-walled cafe.
"It says, by royal appointment, Captain," he said proudly.
"What's it mean?"
Harger scratched his head with a ladle.
"What it means is," he said, "if the king comes in here, he'll like it." "'Have you got anything that isn't too aristocratic for me to eat, then?' said Vimes, sourly, and settled for a slice of plebeian fried bread and a proletarian steak cooked so rare you could still hear it bray. Vimes ate it at the counter. A vague scraping noise disturbed his thoughts. "'What are you doing?' he said. Harger looked up guiltily from his work behind the counter. "'Nothing, Captain,' he said. He tried to hide the evidence behind him when Vimes glared over the knife-chewed woodwork. "'Come on, Sham, you could show me.' Harger's beefy hands came reluctantly into view. "'I was only scraping the old fat out of the pan,' he mumbled. "'I see. And how long have we known each other, Sham?' said Vimes with terrible kindness. "'Years, Captain,' said Harger. "'You've been coming in here nearly every day regular, one of my best customers.' Vimes leaned over the counter until his nose was level with the squashy pink thing in the middle of Harger's face. "'And in all that time... "'Have you ever changed the fat?' he demanded. Harger tried to back away. "'Well, it's been like a friend to me, that old fat,' said Vimes. "'There's little black bits in there I've grown to know and love. "'It's a meal in itself. "'And you've cleaned out the coffee jug, haven't you? "'I can tell. "'This is love in a canoe coffee if ever I tasted it. "'The other stuff had flavour. "'Well, I thought it was time. "'Why?' Harger let the pan fall from his pudgy fingers. Well, I thought, if the king should happen to come in... You're all mad. But, Captain... Vimes's accusing finger buried itself up to the second joint in Harger's expensive vest. You don't even know the wretched fellow's name, he shouted. Harger rallied. I do, Captain, he stuttered. Course I do. Seen it on the decorations and everything. He's called Rex Vivat. Very gently, shaking his head in despair, crying in his heart for the essential servility of mankind, Vimes let him go. In another time and place, the librarian finished reading. He'd reached the end of the text. Not the end of the book. There was plenty more book. It had been scorched beyond the point of legibility, though. Not that the last few unburned pages were very easy to read. The author's hand had been shaking, he'd been writing fast, and he'd blotted a lot. But the librarian had wrestled with many a terrifying text in some of the worst books ever bound. Words that tried to read you as you read them. Words that writhed on the page. At least these weren't words like that. These were just the words of a man frightened for his life. A man writing a dreadful warning. It was a page a little back from the burned section that drew the librarian's eye. He sat and stared at it for some time. Then he stared at the darkness. It was his darkness. He was asleep out there, somewhere. Somewhere out there a thief was heading for this place to steal this book. And then someone would read this book, read these words, and do it anyway. His hands itched. All he had to do was hide the book, or drop onto the thief's head and unscrew it by the ears. He stared into the darkness again. But that would be interfering with the course of history. Horrible things could happen. The librarian knew all about this sort of thing. It was part of what you had to know before you were allowed into L-space. He'd seen pictures in ancient books. Time could bifurcate, like a pair of trousers. You could end up in the wrong leg, living a life that was actually happening in the other leg, talking to people who weren't in your leg, walking into walls that weren't there anymore. Life could be horrible in the wrong trouser of time. Besides, it was against library rules. The three rules of the librarians of time and space are, 1, silence, 2, books must be returned no later than the last date shown, and 3, do not interfere with the nature of causality. The assembled librarians of time and space would certainly have something to say about it if he started to tinker with causality. He closed the book carefully and tucked it back into the shelf. Then he swung gently from bookcase to bookcase until he reached the doorway. For a moment he stopped and looked down at his own sleeping body. Perhaps, he wondered briefly, whether to wake himself up, have a little chat, tell himself that he had friends and not to worry. If so, he must have decided against it. You could get yourself into a lot of trouble that way. Instead, he slipped out of the door, and lurked in the shadows, and followed the hooded thief when it came out clutching the book, and waited near the dread portal in the rain until the elucidated brethren had met, and when the last one left, followed him to his home, and murmured to himself in anthropoid surprise. And then ran back to his library and the treacherous pathways of L-space.